Good evening, listeners. It's June 10th, and you're tuned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can mean only one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Lillian Paget-Cobb.
And I'm Lori Lutz. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight, we are joined by Teresa Fritz Endress from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. Hey, Teresa.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So Teresa studies sediment cores and uses them to study forum shells. And so, Teresa, can you tell us a little bit more about what you do?
Sure. So I study planktonic foraminifera, lovingly called forams. And they are a kind of amoeboid protist that builds a shell out of calcium carbonate, so hard parts. And they float in the surface of the water and live for a couple of weeks. And they record the chemistry of the ocean water in their calcium carbonate shells. And these shells, when the plankton dies, float to the bottom of the water and sit around in sediments for a long period of time. So because they're persistent and ubiquitous in many places of the ocean, they're kind of our best archive of the ocean chemistry. And if we drill into the sediment, we can discover the chemistry of the past all the way back to sometimes 40 million years ago. So they are quite important for the paleo reconstruction.
So this is like a sort of a deep time glimpse into the chemistry of the ocean. I'm curious, how do you take that? How do you look at the shells and really establish that connection to the composition, the chemical composition of the ocean?
Great question. So we drill into seafloor sediments with deep sea drills on vessels that we take into the middle of the ocean. And we take those cores back to the lab and we sample them for these forams that are still persistent in the sediments. We discover the chemistry inside the shell using an instrument called a mass spectrometer. And in that way, you can understand what are the trace elements inside that calcite. So things in the shell besides calcium and carbonate. And these little impurities tell us what sort of variations were happening in the seawater at that time.
So these shells are quite unique. They're not like the shells that you would necessarily find walking along on the beach, right? So one, they're really tiny, correct? And can you just describe to us a little bit what they look like for our listeners?
Yes. So they're about the size of a grain of sand, but they're quite beautiful. And I think there's some photos now on the blog.
Yes. Definitely check out the blog. There's some beautiful photos of forum shells.
Yes. But they are beautiful, geometric, structured, that have beautiful patterns in them, pore spaces and ridges that make kind of roundish shapes. But because there are hundreds of thousands of these planktonic species and tens of thousands of the benthic species, the species that live at the bottom of the water, each of the shapes are associated with different species. So there's a broad suite of different shapes to these things, and each are unique and beautiful.
So do you do any identification by looking at them, or do you only look at the, using the mass spectrometer, do you only look at the composition of the shells?
Yes, the mass spectrometer just tells you the elemental composition. But we also look at the shapes under a light microscope in order to do a higher level identification of the species. And there are folks out there that look at the living ones and the genetic structure of the living ones in order to understand how the shapes relate to what species it is. So with that information, that helps us discover which species it is, because each species incorporates that chemistry differently from one another.
Very cool.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So they're still around today. And so that's an interesting comparison, perhaps, that you can make between the forum shells that you find in ancient sediments and those that are around today. So can you study those differences, perhaps, and to see how that compares over sort of a span or stretch of time?
Yes, absolutely. So as opposed to some fossil species that aren't around anymore, forums very much are, and some species are around today. So that is a really great opportunity to look at the living ones. So some researchers will collect the living ones in surface waters, and then you can do experiments on the lab in the living ones and then look at the chemistry of the shells. So because you have that controlled environment in the lab, you can spike that water with specific chemistry. And then when you look at the shells, you can see how they incorporated that chemistry. So it's a really good proxy, because you can also test on things that you can control rather than just trying to make guesses about the fossils that you find in the past.
Is that something that you're currently doing now, or is that sort of a future goal to do that?
We're not currently collecting and culturing the forums in the lab yet, but absolutely, that is a goal for our lab. My principal investigator on our projects has done this in the past, and she is very interested in getting culturing going in the lab in the future, and perhaps on Catalina Island, which hosts a center for this kind of collection and culturing down in Southern California, where the waters are warm and really good for collecting tropical species, which turn out to be a really good kind of lab rat for doing this kind of testing.
So one thing I'm wondering is that you are looking at cores, sediment cores from a specific region, right? So is that a particular interest, studying this specific region? And can you tell us about the region you're studying?
Yes, totally. So I'm currently working on a project that involves deep sea sediment cores across the equatorial Pacific. So on the eastern side of the equatorial Pacific, it's an upwelling region, which means that water comes from the deep ocean to the surface there because of the wind patterns, along with other climate conditions. And that water is really high in nutrients because the nutrients haven't been scavenged out of the surface water yet. So this really high nutrient water also brings a lot of productivity with it. So lots of organisms will bloom because of this, which feeds the whole food web. So on the eastern side of the equatorial Pacific is quite productive. That same story isn't true on the western side of the Pacific. So looking at forum shells on the eastern side versus the western side, we're hoping to dial in on a potentially new-ish proxy for productivity for this amount of organic matter in the water and productivity of the ecosystem at the surface.
So I'm wondering, when you say productivity, can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by what productivity actually means?
Well, it all starts with the phytoplankton. We assess productivity in different ways. One way is looking at the color of the water from space. You can tell how green the water is. That's a proxy for productivity as well. So you can think of it that way, as really how green and then what the abundance is then of phytoplankton, which of course are the base of the food web, so everything springs from that.
Okay, so are you looking at a range of time specifically?
Yes, so the cores go back to the last glacial maximum is the time period that we're interested in looking at. So the last time that there were major ice sheets covering much of the northern hemisphere. I mean, to think of it down to, you know, the Midwest and to Massachusetts, there was about a mile high ice sheet over Boston. And that was about 20,000 years ago. So you can imagine the climate was very different back then. The climate of the ocean was very different back then as well.
And so, just out of curiosity, in terms of how far you would have to look in the sediment core, what sort of, I guess, length of the sediment core does 20,000 years represent?
Well, it's quite different depending on where in the ocean you are. And so we talked about on the eastern side of the Pacific, where it's quite productive, the cores are much longer to get down to the last glacial maximum. But in the central Pacific and the western Pacific, where things aren't quite as productive, our forearms are also not growing as much, and as well as everything, so the sediments aren't quite as accumulated there. Okay. Because of the productivity above. So those cores are much shorter. But generally, they're a couple meters to get down to the last glacial maximum.
Okay, wow. So that's not even that far, really.
That's right.
That's interesting.
And some cores we can drill down quite deep. The deepest cores are in the order of about 1,000 meters deep. So it's much harder to get those cores, but you can look back in time much further in that record.
So I'm curious, once you collect these cores, what do you do with them? Like, what does the actual lab work look like for you?
Sure. So the cores are that I'm working with now are currently being housed in the core repository here on campus, the Marine Geology Center over at Western. And that's a really great space because it's a whole library of cores that have been collected and saved there over the years for many people to study. So these cores, some of them were collected in the 80s by a now retired OSU vessel. So we're lucky enough to be able to sample those cores, which means that we scoop out basically a centimeter of sediment, which represents about 1,000 years, sometimes shorter, depending on the resolution. And then we take that material and we rinse it kind of like a pour over coffee. And what's left is just the larger pieces of sediment, which are mostly forams, showing you just how ubiquitous these things are in the sediments. That's kind of all that's left. And then we look at them under the light microscope and select the species, like we were talking about before, based on the shapes of the shells. And once we have the species that we want and the size, we can assess them further, both visually and then with that elemental analysis with mass spectrometry.
So this core repository is pretty unique to OSU, is that correct? Or there, I'm sure there's other ones throughout the world, but maybe not nearby, do you know?
Yes, we're really lucky to have the repository. It houses many cores from mostly the Pacific, but all over the world as well. So yes, it's quite unique in that way.
That's really neat. So it's just a building with all of these like PVC pipe tubes filled with these cores, right?
That's right. It's a big warehouse, and the warehouse is just filled with racks with slots for the cores. The cores are sliced in half. One core is the working half, which means it can be sampled by those that request and are approved. And the other half is the archived half. So it's supposed to stay there forever. So it's both a library for people to check out cores, as it were, samples, and both to have these cores saved for future analyses.
So talking about the composition, the chemical composition of the forum shells, there's when you measure changes in chemical composition, is there something you're specifically looking for in terms of a change in maybe the abundance of certain chemicals?
Sure. So the project I'm currently working on is looking at the trace element barium, because it's often associated with organic matter. So it should represent how much organic matter was in the water when the forum lived there. Because it's also has a charge of 2, it replaces itself with calcium in the forum shell, but not everywhere. So we're looking at, as a total concentration, as compared to calcium, how much barium there is. And the higher it is, that reflects kind of directly the amount of productivity.
That's really interesting. So I'm wondering, is there, taking a step back from your project, is there sort of a big picture for why this is really important and people should care about what you're doing?
Totally. So as a paleoceanographer, we look back at the past, and the past is kind of our best way of understanding what will happen in the future. It's kind of like looking into a crystal ball, looking at future climate studies. But the crystal ball is really cloudy and murky. So in order to kind of clear up that cloudiness in the crystal ball, we hindcast the models that are trying to resolve these future climate predictions. And if it works in the past, then you know that there are elements of your model that get it quite well. And sometimes they don't. So that's the initiative to try to tweak and improve these vastly complex climate models so that we can get what's going to happen for future climate more precisely.
Okay. So this sounds like sort of an interdisciplinary effort, maybe, with the computer modeling in addition to the sort of research that you're conducting, and sort of it all fits together to sort of improve these climate models, in a sense, right?
Absolutely. It's definitely many different disciplines and a large group of people that are working on this climate question, both looking at the climate of the past and those that try to predict the climate of the future.
That's really cool. So then, taking a step back for you, how did you sort of decide that you wanted to, I guess, not only study this specific area of paleo research, but also come to OSU?
Sure. So in my undergrad, I took a really great class called Life History, and it was a paleontology class from the origins of life, is really what I've focused on, to paleontology of the Holocene, where we currently live. And I just was floored by just the amazingness of how evolution has worked over these past more than 500 million years. And I thought I wanted to study dinosaurs. I really wanted to do paleontology. But now I study things the size of a grain of sand. but they're interesting in their own way. And I was also kind of blown away by the study of climatology. So this was the perfect field for me because it combines those two things, both the paleo aspect and the climate aspect.
Yeah. So what did you get your undergraduate degree in?
My undergraduate degree was in environmental science, and then I decided to narrow down on paleoceanography and worked at San Francisco State University on my master's degree. And then after my master's, I decided to pursue a PhD here at OSU, largely because of my current advisor who came here to start a professorship last year. So she was at the University of California in Davis and doing some really cool things, not just with this paleo part, but also looking at living forams and this culturing piece. So when she came up here, I decided to also start here and also to be at OSU because of the facilities that are available here. The core repository I discussed, the instruments, the mass spectrometers that are all available in our same building, as well as a suite of other things. There's a lot of opportunities here. Oh, and including our research vessels.
Yeah, you mentioned the mass spectrometer, and you mentioned there was a laser coupled to that. And I was wondering how common that is. Is that a really particularly special instrument at OSU?
It's not incredibly common. For example, we didn't have one at San Francisco State University, but UC Davis did, which turned out to be a great space for collaborations and for my opportunities. So it's not terribly common, and we do have quite a good one here at OSU, and some great faculty running that operation.
And was your master's in, it must have been in a similar area to what you're sort of currently studying because you encountered your current advisor?
Yes, it was similar. I was doing work more on the paleo side of things for the master's, and now I'm quite happy and interested in studying more of these living creatures. For example, I had the opportunity to go offshore a couple weeks ago on our research vessel, the Oceanus, and to sample living ones with a vertical net, again, for trying to understand how the living ones incorporate chemistry into their shells.
Very cool. So after your master's degree, you didn't start your PhD right away, right? You did some work with the National Park Service?
Yes, that's right. I worked for the National Forest through the Student Conservation Association, and I worked on Mount Evans in Colorado. That was actually after my undergraduate, and I'm really glad I took a break and when I did that. It was a lot of fun, and I actually had an opportunity to do some climate work too, because people do tree coring there, which is kind of like looking at layers of sediment to go back in time. You look at the rings of a tree to go back in time. And there are really, really old trees there on Mount Evans, about 5,000 years. So wow. People were interested in that there.
That's really cool. how did you find out about that opportunity? Was that something that was recommended to you, or did you sort of sleuth that out on your own?
Yeah, that was recommended by an advisor in my undergraduate who had a couple students do a similar program. And it's a really great way to spend, you know, a season doing something that's different and that's also service-based, because you're working with a national forest and you're working with people in our Forest and Parks Service.
Yeah, that sounds really, really interesting. And so you also had the opportunity to do some teaching as well after you finished your master's?
Yeah, so after my master's, I was at San Francisco State doing the lab-based intro-oceanography classes there. And yeah, I just spent about a year doing that and it was really fun to teach, especially in the lab-based setting, because everything's much more interactive, and there were a couple field trips associated, which is a great thing in San Francisco, where you have access to the ocean. Yeah. Introduce undergraduates to oceanography.
Definitely. So was wondering, looking after your PhD, do you have sort of a plan in mind, something that you'd like to accomplish? Well, what's next?
Well, I'm just starting my first year, so it was a bit of a ways to go here. But no, it's a good question, and I am thinking about this and what I'd like to get out of this. And another great reason for being at OSU is our connection to the USGS, the U.S. Geologic Survey, the Environmental Protection Agency, and NOAA are all quite close to us here, and interconnected in a lot of ways in our program. I would like to work for an agency like this, or work for a national laboratory, continuing to do research, because research is really fun. It's fun to explore this stuff.
Yeah, and this climate research is so important.
Right, yeah, and it's quite relevant currently. Absolutely. Yes.
Excellent. So we have two traditions on this show, and the first one is for you to give a bit of advice either to your former self or to undergraduates or people interested in going in your field. So could you tell us what your advice is and who it's for?
I would say maybe for myself in undergrad, as well as anyone who's interested in pursuing science or more specifically paleo, I would say try it out. Get yourself in a lab. There's a lot of opportunities, especially here at OSU and other institutions, to try out lab work. You either love it or you hate it, and you really have to try. But if you love it, it can be a really great career. So, yes.
Yeah, I think you're not the first person to say that you're interested in paleontology and you thought you were going to study dinosaurs. And so I think that really speaks a lot to just there's so many opportunities out there that you might not even know exist. And so it's really great to kind of get in there and see what's out there and see if it's a right fit for you. So I think that's great.
Absolutely. The other thing that we like to close out the show with is a song of your choosing. And so you selected something for us. And would you tell us what it is and why you selected it?
I chose Once in a Lifetime by the Talking Heads. And I love David Byrne. It's also just kind of a goofy selection that, there's water at the bottom of the ocean and our job is to pick the water up and carry the water. And he says that quite often in the song. But I guess a little more seriously, it's a really great opportunity that I have here and that, other students have here as oceanographers. So I'm really grateful for the opportunities that I have here. So it's kind of what the song is about too.
That's awesome, I love it. All right, so here it is, Once in a Lifetime by the Talking Heads. Thanks, Teresa.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.